What do such people as Emerson, Thoreau, let me see, Frederick Douglass, W.E.B. Du Bois, or Du Bois, as one should say, Stephen Crane, and Faulkner, and Hemingway, and Henry James, what do they all have in common? They're all very significant American authors, of course, and they are all edited and republished in the Great Library of America. Since 1982, the Library of America has been appearing with four or five new volumes every year, and we are tonight going to be talking about that great contribution to American culture, and we'll be talking even more directly about the authors represented therein. Really, a program tonight about American literature, about American letters, with a very distinguished panel. Daniel Aaron was for many years the president of the Library of America, one of the founding directors of the whole enterprise. And in 1982, when the enterprise just began, he appeared on the program, and here he is again tonight. With him as well, Max Rudin, the current publisher of the Library of America series, and also two local literary scholars, Benjamin Goluboff, who is professor of English at Lake Forest College, and Chris Messenger, who is professor of English at the University of Chicago, of Illinois, Chicago. We'll be talking about American literature, about the canon, and how it is being expanded, and we'll be talking about the joys and the distinctive voice of American authors in the large and ever-growing and ever more thrilling range of American literature as represented in the Library of America. All of that to commence with lots of readings from various authors. All of that to commence directly after the usual update on the evening's news from Lyle Dean. Well, how do we introduce our program tonight? The topic is vast and really unmanageably large, and we've got an excellent cast of characters sitting around the table. The topic is nothing more or less than American literature, and we can't do full justice to American literature, but we will try. We'll also do a good deal of reading from some major works in the canon. And whether there should or should not be a canon is one of the things we will discuss. And we'll be discussing these matters with Daniel Aaron, who was the president of the Library of America and is a member of its board of directors, professor of English, now emeritus at Harvard University. And Dan Aaron was with us some 14 years ago when the Library of America was just getting started. Chris Messenger is professor of English at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Benjamin Goluboff is professor of English at Lake Forest College. Max Rudin is the publisher of the Library of America. I suppose, just to make matters very, very clear to the uninitiated and all of those under 30 who may be listening to us and didn't hear Dan Aaron when he was here 14 years ago, I should ask you, Max, just what is the Library of America, as if I didn't know.
Very briefly, the Library of America is an independent, nonprofit publishing program that is dedicated to publishing really an authoritative national library of American writing. It's an ongoing project, and it aims to include all the best and most significant American writing and to make that heritage available for future generations.
It's available. There are some 90 or more volumes at the moment since 1982. They're wonderfully done physically. They're beautifully bound, beautifully printed. Of course, the editing is of high scholarly excellence, and it's all very available. It's a great thing to have on your shelves. I hereby testify it. I've got lots of these particular editions on my shelf. But it all began, did it not, Dan, as I remember from our talking about this only a mere 14 years ago, it began with an idea from Edmund Wilson, didn't it?
That's right. Partly because he loved American literature, and unlike many of his contemporaries, he was reading American books when he was still in the Hill School, even before he went to Princeton. Later on, he felt in his own writings that the books that he wanted when he was doing his research, but he couldn't find the books, that they weren't in print. He had a hard time finding them even in used bookstores, and it irritated him that he wasn't able to have these books readily because his library had complete sets. He didn't want to do anything unless he had read everything.
And you remember the great French edition called the Pléiade.
The Pléiade, that was the model that he had in mind.
Yeah, all the great French authors.
All the great
together in one.
Although
major
the Pléiade actually did American authors too.
I didn't know that.
Yes, they did. There's a play out Faulkner.
Uh-huh.
And a Poe. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In any event, this was, I would say, he was talking to me about this as early as 1960. He tried very hard to get some kind of funding for it. He almost succeeded. But then the MLA books came along and the scholarly editions, and that created a great friction between Edmund Wilson and members of the Modern Library Association. That was patched up finally, and eventually, it's a long, long story. The group of us came together after Wilson died in 1972, and we were funded by the National Endowment of the Humanities and the Ford Foundation, and we started out, and that's when I came here, Milt.
What were the very first volumes that you and your colleagues chose?
It was Harold Beecher Stowe, Jack London. Those were both prizes for many people.
Yeah.
Walt Whitman, and I can't
Hawthorne.
And Hawthorne.
Yeah.
Yes.
The basic approach has been, was then, and remains to this day, not to do just a single major work. When you do Harriet Beecher Stowe, you don't merely do Uncle Tom's Cabin, but you draw a number of things together and put them all into one.
Right. The idea was never to have the greatest hits series. It was to have the collected work
of the great writers.
So each edition is an omnibus volume. They have up to 1,200 pages.
We've got two professors of English and thus of literary criticism inevitably with us at the moment, Benjamin Golubov and Chris Messenger. There's been a large and continuing debate in the precincts where you guys work, in the literary critical world, as to whether the very notion of a canon is a kind of an imposition on and against the colonial peoples of the world or the struggling masses or what have you. The canon is a way of putting people down by freezing deviant authors out. Do either of you buy that?
Well, I think a canon has to be a perpetually changing mosaic. America is nothing if not a vital country, and it has a vital literature. And one of the things about a canon is that it's always if it's really alive and vital, it's incorporating new accents, making new choices, incorporating things like our founding documents or great landmark speeches, histories, travel documents, journals, essays, memoirs. It's as eclectic as the country itself, and it's an accretion of texts over a period of time.
There's not a fixed canon. The Bible, both testaments, is canonical. There are many books which go to make up the Old Testament, that is the Hebrew Bible, and others which go to make up the Christian New Testament, and they don't change. That's not a canon.
Well, divine inspiration is kind of a rigid criteria. It's a very rigid criterion.
Yes, perhaps so. That's an unchanging canon, but ours should be a changing canon.
You're right in saying that the debate rages where we work, but one place where it does not rage where we work is among our students. I find at least that students aren't at all current or invested in the debate over canon, and they have to be presented with both sides of the issue before they'll take it much to heart. When they do begin to take it to heart, I think they think rather conservatively about it. They have the sense that if we're going to get our tuition dollars worth, we're to be given the classics.
And we should read Hawthorne and Whitman and who else?
Melville, Stowe, Mark Twain, and so forth. Meanwhile, of course, the whole idea of a classic in every other cranny of the academy is quite under attack.
Ben, if you asked your students to draw up a list of what they consider to be canonical works of American literature, would they be able to answer? What would they do? Would they actually include Hawthorne, Melville, Whitman?
I think not.
Uh-huh.
I think not. They might say Hemingway. They might say Faulkner out of the sense that they heard the name echoing in the corridors of their high school. They're not familiar with the names or the titles, but they do have this sense that it has to be leather-bound and ivy-encrusted and old.
Yeah.
It's time for me to tell you about the survey I did today. I was mentioning it to the four of you before we came on the air. In my seminar, which I conducted just this afternoon, in a course in psychology, to be sure, but still, rather bright undergraduates, just a group of about 15, three of them graduates, the rest undergraduates, I simply put on the board the names of 11 American authors and asked my students to list whatever titles they associate with those authors. I told them, you don't have to have read the book, but if you know its title, list it. And I found that they did very well with people like Nathaniel Hawthorne. They did very poorly with, I'm running down the list, Edith Wharton. Quite a number of them pulled an absolute blank on Edith Wharton. They did most of them well. That is, could name three or four titles with Mark Twain, with Henry James, everybody named The Turn of the Screw, everybody who had anything, some didn't have anything. A Turn of the Screw was the most frequently named, and Portrait of a Lady was also named. Obviously, this reflects what they are asked to read in some other courses. Ernest Hemingway, they had quite a lot, the one or two somehow managed to attribute other authors' works to Hemingway. John Steinbeck, whom I threw on that list, surprisingly produced a fair number of accurate titles. Strangely, most of them had nothing for William Faulkner, had nothing for Norman Mailer, though I think one guy mentioned the Executioner's Song, and one did mention The Naked and the Dead, but that's two mentions out of some 15 students. And I put on the list as well William Dean Howells. Not a single person could name a single work by William Dean Howells. One student wrote, William Dean who?
You know, I think that one of the reasons is they haven't made movies out of their books.
Perhaps so.
You think that I'm surprised that they didn't know Edith Wharton, because she's been very popular, especially with women students. And that very bad novel she wrote called The Buccaneers, they made a TV thing out of it, which is, but it's really sort of woman's magazine circa 1920s quality.
But Dan, the one that fascinated and in a way dismayed me the most.
Right.
Another man on the list was Saul Bellow, who was not only a great American novelist, but was a professor at the University of Chicago for some 30 years. He left us to go to Boston University only about 2 years ago. And not one of my students listed The Adventures of Augie March. Another made mention of a book about Israel. She couldn't quite remember its title, but she remembered it's about Israel, and it's nonfiction. That would be To Jerusalem and Back, I think, is the title. Otherwise, they had no titles of Saul Bellow's at all.
Well,
what do you think
of
that?
I think one of the ironies of You talk about Mailer, and if you mentioned Bowen, you could put Philip Roth on this list, Bernard Mallon. I mean, one of the first great insurgent movements in the contemporary American fiction period was the emphasis on Jewish American fiction in the 1960s.
Yeah, those, the guys you mentioned are the Jewish mafia.
Joseph Heller and Bruce J. Friedman, and a writer who died much too young, Edward Lewis Walland, and others. And It was in the best sense, a multi-ethnic American literature movement, but it came before the emphasis on multi-ethnicity that is now in the American university, and therefore now it is seen as an historically capped phenomenon that is part of the past of the contemporary period instead of being part of its present. And so they become not dead white male writers, but simply part of a literary movement that is now looked at as not having an ongoing productive capacity, although obviously Bellow is still writing and Mailer is still writing and Roth still writing. I think our students often think it's sort of like put on the cuffs, professor. Whatever you tell us to read is what we should read. But you can't start debates in your class in many interesting ways with very very traditional writers and new writers. For example, the idea that Henry David Thoreau went to Walden Pond in 1845 to front the facts of life, as he said, and he published Walden in 1854. In 1845, Frederick Douglass publishes his narrative of his history of his life as a slave. Thoreau graduated from Harvard in 1837. Douglass escaped from slavery in 1837. But what we inevitably get around to in class when we talk about Douglass and Thoreau together is that Thoreau got that Harvard degree first before he decided to go to Walden Pond. He had the option to go to Walden Pond. He could have cleaned himself up, gone to Boston, done whatever he wanted, whereas for Douglass, it was an absolute life decision to reinvent himself, whereas for Thoreau, it was a rhetorical trope or a pose, which doesn't denigrate the brilliance of Thoreau's writing, but it makes the immediacy of Douglass' survival, his necessity to create himself, so much stronger, so much more vital, and therefore it makes us now look at Thoreau in a different light, not necessarily a lesser light, but he now has to step up to the bar and answer for himself a little bit in this canonical table. If you consider it a table with maybe not a finite number of chairs, but someone's going to get elbowed out of the way so someone else can get in. That's also the
I remember what heightens the contrast even a little more between Thoreau and Douglass. Something I learned from Leon Adele a number of years ago, that when Thoreau went to Walden Pond to live in that little hut and was sort of roughing it, he managed to go back home to his mother's house almost every day for lunch. It wasn't exactly a life of isolation and...
I don't think he did it every day.
Well, he felt that it was pretty much a regular
thing. He did go back. But I think that in the case of Thoreau, you have another reason why certain writers may reach a sort of period where they don't seem to move up or down the literary scale, and then something comes along like the environmental movement. So there's another way of approaching writers, and there's a great interest in, and will be increasingly so, and I think we hope to capitalize that in the Library of America, writers like naturalists, explorers. We're going to do John Muir. We've just done William Bartram, the marvelous early 19th century naturalist in Philadelphia, who wrote this marvelous account of going down into Georgia and South Carolina and Alabama, and his accounts of animal life and birds and flowers and the Indians and that sort of thing. And I think that's going to be... I'm sorry, I had a signal for something else. I think this is going to be increasingly true, and there'll be new discoveries of American writers.
Now, gentlemen, here's the plan. We pause rather often for commercials. We're about to do that. I offer you a kind of epigraph for the rest of this program from Edith Hamilton, who's not so far in the Library of America. She was, of course, a classical scholar. And she says, "A people's literature is the great textbook for real knowledge of them. The writings of the day show the quality of people as no historical reconstruction can." Therefore, the proposition would be, of course, that as we look at some of the great American writers who are contained within the Library of America, we get a reflection of some main currents and some side eddies and some patterns of conflict and growth and change in American culture itself. And I would propose that from this point on, right after the impending commercials, we plunge into the writers and talk about them and listen to some selections, necessarily brief, from some of those writers who are contained in the Library of America series. And perhaps we can do this more or less chronologically, though we needn't be absolutely strict about that. And so we shall return with, let's see, who's got some of the earliest authors on the list?
I think we should do Bartram, since we just reached the subject of I Have a Passage for Bartram.
Oh, you have a passage for
Bartram. I'm going to start.
Very good. We'll start there, and we'll go to many others, and all of that will proceed right after these words. A brief overview of American literature, drawing from authors, all of whom I think are represented in the great American Pleiad, or the equivalent thereof, namely the Library of America, of which Max Rudin is the publisher, of which Daniel Aaron is one of the founders, and in response to which we also have comments and the presence of Benjamin Golubov of Lake Forest College and Chris Messenger of the University of Illinois, Chicago. And we've agreed on a sort of a playlist, as they call it in radio jargon. Bartram is the first. But that's a name that is probably less familiar to most of our listeners than almost any other that we're going to invoke tonight.
I should say, and it was also to people in the office until we began to work on the book and discover what a wonderful writer he is. Bartram was, I guess you'd call him the first American environmentalist in a way. He was the first person to devote his
life. What's his full name?
William Bartram. He was the son of John Bartram, who was a botanist in George. And William Bartram was an explorer and a writer and an herbalist and an artist. He kind of looks forward to both Thoreau and Audubon in different ways.
What are his dates?
Oh, I don't have them. Late 18th century, early 19th
late
century.
Late 18th, yeah.
Yeah. He explored what was at that time a vast, unbroken wilderness south of Washington, D.C., basically, the whole area from Virginia to Florida, in the 1770s. And in the 1790s, published a famous account of it called Bartram's Travels.
This was the Cherokee country before the Cherokee
moved west. Exactly
right.
That's exactly right. In this passage, which is a brief passage, Bartram is in Florida, and he is in the woods, and he sees this clear spring, which has multicolored fish emerging from it. And this is what he writes. "I seated myself upon a swelling green knoll at the head of a crystal basin, the waters of which are so extremely clear as to be absolutely diaphanous or transparent as the ether. Just under my feet was the enchanting and amazing crystal fountain, which incessantly threw up from dark, rocky caverns below tons of water every minute, a continual and amazing ebullition. Innumerable bands of fish are seen, some clothed in the most brilliant colors. There are no signs of enmity, no attempt to devour each other, the different bands seem peacefully and complacently to move a little aside, as it were to make room for others to pass by. But behold yet something far more admirable. See whole armies descending into an abyss, into the mouth of the bubbling fountain. They disappear. Are they gone forever? Is it real? I raise my eyes with terror and astonishment. I look down again at the fountain with anxiety, when I behold them, as it were, emerging from the blue ether of another world, apparently at a vast distance. At their first appearance, no bigger than flies or minnows, now gradually enlarging, their brilliant colors begin to paint the fluid. Now they come forward rapidly and instantly emerge with the elastic expanding column of crystalline waters into the circular basin or funnel. See now how gently they rise, some upright, others obliquely, or seem to lie as it were on their sides, suffering themselves to be gently lifted or borne up by the expanding fluid toward the surface, sailing or floating like butterflies in the cerulean ether. Then again they gently descend, diverge, and move off. This amazing and delightful scene, though real, appears at first as a piece of excellent painting. There seems no medium. You imagine the picture to be within a few inches of your eyes, and that you may without the least difficulty touch any one of the fish, when really it is 20 or 30 feet below the water. What I especially like about that passage is, like Thoreau, there's something going on about the literal and the figurative level. But here, not only is it an actual scene being described, but it somehow also seems like a scene from, you know, the Voyages of Sinbad or the Arabian Nights. There's something fantastic about it. And it's interesting that, you know, both Coleridge and Wordsworth picked up on this passage. Coleridge used the image of the fountain for his fountain in Kubla Khan. And although Bartram's reputation in the United States had to wait till the 1930s, he's actually extremely popular among the Romantic nature writers on the continent. So it's an interesting example also of kind of literary reputation being made. So, but clearly, Bartram, nature writing begins with Bartram, really, in America. I mean, a conscious reflection on American nature.
I really don't know that word.
There's one thing that has to be said about Bartram, too, and that's he's made a sort of a lasting botanical contribution. He discovered a species on the banks of the Altamaha, Altamaha River, a beautiful flowering tree, which he had seen cataloged, recorded nowhere before. He named it the Franklinia Altamaha, and brought seeds of it home and sent seeds to London. And it's now a commonly available flowering tree in the trade, but it's disappeared from the wild. Yeah. He caught it just on the verge of going extinct, and now it survives in arboreta and in gardens, thanks to Bartram.
That's right. Hmm. Actually, there's the Bartram House and Garden in Philadelphia are a National Historic Site, where you can actually see a Franklinia tree and other things.
You've got a volume in the Library of America series of his works, I gather, with some very good natural illustrations as well.
That's right. It includes not only his great classic, the book I just quoted from, but also other ethnographic papers. He was one of the first Americans to write about the Indians in a sympathetic way. Mm-hmm. Bartram has an interesting combination of scientific eye and Quaker spirituality, which kind of lends some of that combination of insight and naivete to his writing. And yes, he also was an artist, and we have actually the first color plates in the series.
Did Audubon write?
Yes.
He did, didn't he?
Oh, yes.
I remember. Of course, he's not American-born.
He was born in the West Indies, wasn't he? And
there was once the rumor that he was the Dauphin of France.
Yes, that was the thing. But he was. But he's considered to be an American writer.
Yeah.
And eventually, I hope he's going to get into the Library of America.
Yeah.
He has this descriptions of American nature, wild and fantastic and exact all at the same time, some of his drawings of his birds. But he wrote good prose and descriptions of physical events like tornadoes and things of that kind.
Have you people on the board of the Library of America thought of contemplated Lewis and Clark as a possible
project? Yes, we have.
Project? There's been a good deal of publication of the Lewis and Clark journals.
The trouble with that is that it would be very, very difficult to reproduce because there's no good edition of it, and there's an awful lot of material which doesn't really lend itself to general reading.
There's a 14-volume Nebraska edition, which is a little too large for our
series.
If we can find the perfect editor to condense it into two volumes, we would hire him, actually.
Onward and upward, or at least sideways, or whatever. On our playlist, we've got Nathaniel Hawthorne listed next. Why?
I think it's because we're thinking about moving into some American literature of Civil War, and this is a funny kind of preamble to this. This is Hawthorne's preface to his last novel called The Marble Faun, published, I think, in 1860, and the preface is written in 1859. And The Marble Faun is an ungainly and difficult novel taking place in Italy. And the sort of fantastic premise in it is one of our characters a mythological faun with pointed furry ears somehow survived into the 19th century, or is he not? But anyway, if we're talking or beginning to talk about the American literature of the Civil War, here's Hawthorne in 1859 as things are sliding to the brink, talking. As was customary in many prefaces to American novels, about America as if it were a place where fiction could not well be written. And this is very striking, given what he says, especially because we're talking about 1859. He writes, "The romance, The Marble Faun, was sketched out during a residence of considerable length in Italy and has been rewritten and prepared for the press in England. The author proposed to himself merely to write a fanciful story, evolving a thoughtful moral, and did not purpose attempting a portraiture of Italian manners and character. He has lived too long abroad not to be aware that a foreigner seldom acquires that knowledge of a country, at once flexible and profound, which may justify him in endeavoring to idealize his traits, its traits. Italy, as the site of his romance, was chiefly valuable to him as affording a sort of poetic or fairy precinct where actualities would not be so terribly insisted upon as they are and must needs be in America. No author without a trial can conceive of the difficulty of writing a romance about a country where there is no shadow, no antiquity, no mystery, no picturesque and gloomy wrong, nor anything but a commonplace prosperity in broad and simple daylight, as is happily the case with my dear native land. It will be very long, I trust, before romance writers may find congenial and easily handled themes, either in the annals of our stalwart republic, or in any characteristic and probable events of our individual lives. Romance and poetry, like ivy, lichens, and wallflowers, need ruin to make them grow." Here's Hawthorne writing in 1859 as all hell is about to break
loose. Also saying that you can't really write about America, which is too bland, it's all in the sunshine, when in fact he wrote one of the fiercest and darkest American novels in The Scarlet Letter.
Of course. Imagining that America hasn't got a history when American history was its stock in trade,
yeah.
And imagining that the American present of his moment was all commonplace, sunshiny prosperity, as indeed it was not. I mean, this is a conventional complaint of the American novelist. You hear it in Cooper's Notions of the Americans. But you would think that a year from the firing on Fort Sumter,
curious.
Hawthorne would have gotten wise.
A very curious piece. Leading up to the Civil War, one of the great figures, we've mentioned him already, is Frederick Douglass, an exceptional figure in American history and in American literature. And Douglass is in the Library of America series as well.
The three different autobiographical narratives he wrote are collected in one volume.
And Chris, you have something of that.
Yes, well, the first of these narratives was in 1845, the narrative of the life of Frederick Douglass, an American slave. And it was originally written under the auspices of the William Lloyd Garrison and the Abolitionist Society. It was sort of their standard pamphlet. And Douglass was in the process at this point of breaking away from the abolitionists. He was tired of being exhibited on stage and told, "Tell your story, Frederick," and at the end of it he would take his shirt off. And finally he wasn't taking his shirt off anymore to show scars or to show anything about his physical body. But what's staggering about Douglass, even as early as 1845, is the suppleness of his writing style and the number of different accents he gets into any one piece of his writing. This is from chapter 5 of the narrative. when he's very excited as a teenager, still a slave, about to embark on a trip to Baltimore, where he's going to live in a city and perhaps he hopes be educated. I was seldom whipped by my old master and suffered little from anything else than hunger and cold. I suffered much from hunger, but much more from cold. In hottest summer and coldest winter, I was kept almost naked. No shoes, no stockings, no jacket, no trousers. Nothing on but a coarse tow linen shirt, reaching only to my knees. I had no bed. I must have perished with cold, but that the coldest nights, I used to steal a bag which was used for carrying corn to the mill. I would crawl into this bag, and there sleep on the cold, damp clay floor, with my head in and my feet out. My feet have been so cracked with the frost that the pen with which I am writing might be laid in the gashes. We were not regularly allowanced. Our food was coarse cornmeal boiled. This was called mush. It was put into a large wooden tray or trough and set down upon the ground. The children were then called like so many pigs, and like so many pigs they would come and devour the mush, some with oyster shells, others with pieces of shingle, some with naked hands, and none with spoons. He that ate fastest got most. He that was strongest secured the best place, and few left the trough satisfied. I was probably between 7 and 8 years old when I left Colonel Lloyd's plantation. I left it with joy. I shall never forget the ecstasy with which I received the intelligence that my old master, Anthony, had determined to let me go to Baltimore to live with Mr. Hugh Auld, brother to my old master's son-in-law, Captain Thomas Auld. I received this information about 3 days before my departure. They were three of the happiest days I ever enjoyed. I spent most part of all these 3 days in the creek, washing off the plantation scurf and preparing myself for the departure. The pride of appearance which this would indicate was not my own. I spent time in washing not so much because I wished to, but because Mrs. Lucretia had told me I must get all the dead skin off my feet and knees before I could go to Baltimore, for the people in Baltimore were very cleanly and would laugh at me if I looked dirty. Besides, she was going to give me a pair of trousers, which I could not put on unless I got all the dirt off me. The thought of owning a pair of trousers was great indeed. It was almost a sufficient motive not only to make me take off what would be called by pig drovers the mange, but the skin itself. I went at it in good earnest, working for the first time with the hope of reward. In this passage by Douglas, you see him ending almost with a statement that could have been said by Horatio Alger or Benjamin Franklin. He has that accent of the American success story. If I put on trousers, I can be a man, I can be an American, I can be a person rather than a thing. And I went at it in good earnest, working for the first time with the hope of reward. He's being socialized into a system, and he wants to be. But there's also such image of animality here. He crawls into a feed bag for warmth and clothing rather than eating what comes out of the feed bag. Douglas was a natural. I mean, he could take disparate notions of time and space, of clothing and food, change them around and make them work for his own rhetoric. His statement about his feet being cracked with the frost and laying the pen in the gashes fits right away with what the contemporary critical establishment would call writing on the body, or writing of the body. And certainly all slave narratives are intensely concerned with the whippings and the scars that are left, both the physical scars and the emotional scars. There's animal imagery, and there's Benjamin Franklin, too. And it's all going to the city, which is one of the quintessential American stories. But there's hope here. And Douglas, of course, was the great conciliatory presence among slaves who were pushing for their freedom, who always said, we intend to make America live up to its promises for everyone. We are not going anywhere. We are not going back to Africa. We are staying, and we intend to be Americans, too. We want the founding documents to be our documents.
It was also a hortatory voice, was it not? I mean, if Frederick Douglass hadn't been there and hadn't written and didn't speak, and he was a great orator, apparently, quite likely the abolitionist movement wouldn't have thrived and matured as quickly as it did.
Well, you know, I was thinking about what you were saying about Douglass. That first version that you're reading is the most eloquent, finally, of the three. It becomes, as he develops it, he becomes more self-conscious, and the voice becomes more orotund. Mm. It doesn't have that kind of simple power, it seems to me, that the first version does. And now we're coming to an enormously big subject, the way American writers responded to the Civil War. And I go back to what Ben was saying. Hawthorne on the verge of the Civil War and writing about realism in America and why we could never have the the lore, the history, the culture of the old world. It's a view that was heeded right down to the 1920s and 30s. And yet, you know, Hawthorne was one of the greatest realists of all, and his view of the Civil War was a much darker view of the war, less triumphalist. He was against enthusiasm, and he was against abolitionists. He and his friend Melville, who had long talks about these things, presumably, but we don't know what they talked about, both took a rather dark view of it. I think they both saw in the war a change of American society from a republican, simple, agrarian society to a new industrial society. And that's in a way that they were writing about. So for both of them, the Civil War was a great disaster. Writers like Emerson and Thoreau and many of the New England writers, I don't think really understood black people. They defended them, they praised them, they held them up, defended them, and accused their oppressors. But they were there, and I think this is possibly true for Harriet Beecher Stowe.
I was about to ask you, did Harriet Beecher Stowe understand black people?
That is a question we could all talk about.
Yeah. Well, remember that Lincoln, when he meets her, says, "You're the little lady who started this war."
Yes, apocryphally he said that. I'm never sure that he said that. But in any event, he was reputed to have said that.
Well, there's even a wonderful story about Douglas, too, who was visiting Lincoln during the war and was in the what passed for the Oval Office in 1864. And some political supplicant came to see Lincoln late of a fall afternoon, and the shadows were very deep in the office. And there was a figure standing by the window of Lincoln's office, and the political man came in, and he said stutteringly, Are you the president?" And the man turned around and said, "No, sir, I am Frederick Douglass." And it was Douglass who was already waiting in the office to see Lincoln. Douglass never tired of repeating that story.
We have some commercials that are overdue, I fear. We'll take care of those and then directly back to additional samplings from 19th century American literature, though we're working towards the 20th as well. We return right after these words. From the riches of American literature over more than two centuries, we cannot do full justice, obviously, to American literature. You can't put it all in any collection of volumes, and surely you can't put it all into 2 hours of radio time. But the collection of volumes with which you can do a great deal, and a great deal has been done, and it is ever growing, is the Library of America, represented here by Max Rutan, publisher of the Library of America, and Daniel Aaron, who is one of the founders and original conceivers of the library, and is still a member of its board of directors. Daniel Aaron is as well professor of English emeritus at Harvard University. Our other two guests are Benjamin Golubov, who is professor of English at Lake Forest College, and Chris Messenger, who is the same at the University of Illinois, Chicago. We come towards Lincoln. I was very impressed by the volume, it's two volumes of Lincoln, of the work of Lincoln, yeah, in the Library of America series. Let's talk about, for a moment, before we read something from Lincoln, about what's in those volumes.
A large, over 400 individual items, including proclamations, messages, letters, from Lincoln's entire public career, from the 1830s until his death in 1865, including, you know, some of the most moving documents in 19th century American culture.
And some correspondence as well.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. What do we have by way of a sample?
And Lincoln Beckwith's debate.
Yes, indeed, right.
Since we're on the subject of Civil War, one of the most moving moments in that is Lincoln's second inaugural address, and it would be worth reading this just to show that, you know, novelists and poets have a monopoly on beautiful and powerful writing. This is March 4, 1865, the second portion of the inaugural address. Lincoln says, "If we shall suppose American slavery is one of those offenses which, in the providence of God, must needs come, but which, having continued through the appointed time, he now wills to remove, and that he gives to both North and South this terrible war as the woe due to those by whom the offense came, shall we discern therein any departure from those divine attributes which the believers in a living God always ascribe to him? Fondly do we hope, fervently do we pray, that this mighty scourge of war may speedily pass away. Yet if God wills that it continue, until all the wealth piled by the bondman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword. As was said 3,000 years ago, so still it must be said. The judgments of the Lord are true and righteous altogether. With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in, to bind up the nation's wounds, to care for him who shall have borne the battle, and for his widow and his orphan, to do all which may achieve in Paris a just and a lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations. It's hard to really say anything about that.
He didn't have a speechwriter
put that together for him either. I mean, what's, you know, Lincoln's, you know, the simple dignity of expression, the biblical cadences, the American flavor of it. I mean, you can almost, when you read Lincoln, like when you read Mark Twain, you feel that they're inventing the American language.
What is the date of the second inaugural?
That's March 1865.
Only a month before his assassination.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yes.
Tremendously moving.
Yeah, it's really not much we can say.
You know, I must say, we don't have a sample of it here tonight, but one of the wonderful volumes in the Library of America, which I got some while ago, is the memoirs of Ulysses Grant, who was also a great natural stylist and a great master of the English, of American English.
Right. It's a big favorite of Gertrude Stein's, actually, that book. I should say that the Lincoln volumes and the Grant and Sherman volumes are the four best-selling volumes of the entire series.
Are they?
Yes.
Yeah. There is one of the great moments in American literature, just as it is one of the great moments in American history, the surrender of Lee to Grant at Appomattox Courthouse. And Grant telling you that he's very touched and very honored by the fact that Lee remembers him, Grant. Lee, once having been the commandant of West Point, was it when Grant was a student or when Grant was...
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
An undistinguished one.
Yeah, quite undistinguished. But the quaintness of that scene and of his rendering of it is really...
Yeah, it's
beautiful.
A great moment in democracy.
He's much better writer than Lee.
he's
been compared to Tacitus or Caesar. It's a kind of style.
Yeah.
John W. DeForest, who was one of the American writers who actually fought in the war, admired Grant's style very much. And he said that he didn't swagger. He didn't show off. It's like Hemingway at his best.
Spare.
It's very spare.
Yeah.
Very.
Do I remember correctly that Mark Twain had a hand in getting Grant to do those memoirs?
Yes,
the American Book Company at Hartford just about Twain's only success as a businessman was the publication of Grant's memoirs.
Yeah.
And that was for Grant's widow.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Grant was dying of throat cancer and broke.
Let's take care of another batch of commercials, and then we turn, still lingering with the Civil War and its reflection in a large portion of American literature, we turn to Walt Whitman. And we'll do that directly after these words.
Rosenberg.
The problem when you organize a program like this, it's a very welcome problem, is we have an embarras de richesse. And there's a great deal that one might read and might talk about, which we can't read, but which we can at least briefly talk about as we rush hither and yon, trying to characterize major periods in the history of American literature. And we'll do that shortly, but right now, still staying with the Civil War, one of the great voices, surely, in the American canon, Walt Whitman. And he was, of course, directly involved in the Civil War, not as a soldier, but as a male nurse.
As a male nurse, he went down. His brother was in the serving in the war. He went down to see him and then saw the misery and horror of the battlefields and the particularly operating on soldiers who had been wounded. And he describes this in very vividly in prose, but he also, in poetry as well. The Civil War was a great test for him and a great crisis because it threatened his whole idea of the Union, and Leaves of Grass was really based on that. I mean, there was a poem about the Union. So it was he felt somehow he had to justify this and to show that out of the Civil War would come the saving of the Union. He was not vindictive the way some of the other Northerners were. He had sympathy for the Southern soldier as well as the Northern soldier, as Melville did too, by the way. And here's one of the poems that he wrote that is part of Drum Taps. his a volume, a part of Leaves of Grass, which deals with the Civil War. This is called A Sight in Camp in the Daybreak, Gray and Dim. A sight in camp in the daybreak, gray and dim, as from my tent I emerge so early sleepless, as slow I walk in the cool, fresh air, the path near by the hospital scent. Three forms I see on stretchers lying, brought out there, untended lying, over each the blanket spread, ample brownish woolen blanket, gray and heavy blanket, folding, covering all. Curious I halt and silent stand. Then, with light fingers, I from the face of the nearest, the first, just lift the blanket. Who are you, elderly man, so gaunt and grim, with well-grayed hair and flesh all sunken about the eyes? Who are you, my dear comrade? Then to the second I step. And who are you, my child and darling? Who are you, sweet boy, with cheeks yet blooming? Then to the third, a face nor child nor old, very calm, as of beautiful yellow white ivory. Young man, I think I know you. I think this face is the face of Christ himself, dread and divine and brother of all, and here again he lies. That quality of poignancy of identification with all Americans, Southern and Northern, he writes often on this brotherhood, which the war temporarily sundered, but which brought them all together at the end. And I think the same view that of Whitman was shared by Melville, who again saw the war as a tragedy involving both right and both wrong, and something that seemed to happen because of malignancy, of the dark passions of in human beings. He was not, he didn't have the optimism that so many of the Northerners had in feeling that all was a great triumph for the North and the building of a nation. And in his battle pieces, this comes out again and again. The war educates, he uses that word in a special way, educates to the real meaning of human destiny and of the forces of black and white that were waging war within the country itself. This is just one poem, a short one, which I'll read, which is appropriately titled A Requiem. And it is called Shiloh, and it was the Battle of Shiloh, which was ended up as a Northern victory, but at tremendous cost to both Southern armies and Northern armies. Grant nearly had a great catastrophe, but pulled it out. But it was written about very frequently by poets and by American writers who participated in it, like Ambrose Bierce. This is the poem. Skimming lightly, wheeling still, the swallows fly low over the field in clouded days, the forest field of Shiloh. Over the field where April rain solaced the parched one stretched in pain, through the pause of night that followed the Sunday fight around the church of Shiloh, the church so lone, the log-built one, that echoed to many a parting groan and natural prayer of dying foemen mingled there. Foemen at morn, but friends at eve, fame or country, least their care. What like a bullet can undeceive? But now they lie low, while over them the swallows skim, and all is hushed at Shiloh.
Yes, that is a fine poem. I remember it. I was thinking, as you were reading the Whitman, somebody once told me probably the worst poem Walt Whitman ever wrote is another one. It's one that he did in meter and rhyme.
Captain,
my captain, our fearful trip is done.
Yeah.
How is it? The ship has weathered every storm. The prize we saw is won. How does it go from there?
I did not memorize that poem.
It is his memorial poem upon the assassination of Abraham Lincoln.
Well, it was the great poem was when
Lilacs Laughed in the Dooryard Bloomed. Yeah,
that's the great elegy. I don't know actually what prompted him to write that, except that Whitman did want popular attention, and he wasn't read, and was not highly regarded by the people whom he would wish to be
regarded by. Seriously, the only
by.
Whitman that they taught us when I was a yes. in elementary school in New York City
yes.
was because, Captain My Captain.
Yes, sure.
Well, occasional poems often have that forced, overly
that
rhetorical
declamatory
quality about them. Yeah. But I think one of the interesting things about the Whitman poem that you read, Daniel, was that there's a kind of tenderness in his manliness and a sympathy that is a sort of masculine presence that is almost hard to define in our time. We find it hard to recreate it. It's strong, and yet it's absolutely open to the horror and the beauty of the dying men.
No.
My dear comrade, my child and darling. Without any kind of coyness about it at all. It is just absolutely authoritative.
He said, expressed the same thing in his accounts of tending these wounded soldiers, and he would go and bring them things, he would write letters for them, he would inquire about them afterwards and keep in touch with some of them. That gave him an opportunity to express his, what some people would say, homoerotic feelings,
no.
legitimately.
But it's really the power yes. of sentimental writing in this period. It is not a pejorative to call it sentimental. Not in the sense that the 1850s or the 1860s
yeah,
saw.
I would never call that.
Too much of the 20th century reaction against sentimentality has made us unaware or insensitive to the power of this.
Now, gentlemen, I must point out something. Do you realize that here we've been talking for about an hour about American literature, canonical more or less, in that all of these authors are published in the Library of America series, and we've said virtually nothing about the American novel, virtually nothing about American fiction. To be sure, we heard something of the preface to the Marvel Fawn, but we haven't really talked about the great novelists. Let us therefore do that. Who was the first significant American novelist, would you say? And we're not going to read from all of them, but just to do a quick overview. Would it be James Fenimore Cooper?
I imagine it would be in sort of translating Walter Scott's historical novel
yeah.
into native terrain.
The leather stocking novels are Scott on the Western Shore, so to speak.
Exactly. They called him the American Scott
yeah.
and so forth.
And then beyond Cooper, how does one track, when you teach it, how do you track the development of the American novel?
Well, you do. I defer to you, Ben.
Oh, God. You were about to say Brown, you're thinking Charles Bronson Brown, an American Gothic novelist, who I think is sort of slipping out of.
And we're getting to about a year and a half. We'll be bringing out Brown
restored. They're difficult novels to include in one syllabus in that they're very creaky, difficult books.
One of the great figures, surely, is the poet whom we heard last, who also wrote a few interesting novels, namely Herman Melville.
And Melville's one of the great, one of the great romantic voices of the period, one of the many American figures who has sort of flirted with the idea of an American epic and perhaps brought it off more convincingly than Joel Barlow or those early people trying to do the national character in hexameters.
Isn't it the case though that most Americans who read know Melville only through Moby Dick and much of the rest of his work, and there are some, how many novels are there? Probably 10 or 12 at least.
Well, by Moby Dick he was already losing his audience. The irony
yeah.
is, of course, that Moby Dick is the great rediscovered 20th century classic,
yeah.
but in the 1840s Melville had been an adventure writer, specifically about the South Seas,
yes,
and it titillated
so.
Middle-class audiences with hints of incest and cannibalism and
right.
miscegenation and so forth. And yet his romances became increasingly abstract as the 1840s wore on, and Moby Dick, he lost his audience, and then he really turned on his audience and began to write both long and short works, which would say, see if you can figure this out. And
mm-hmm.
and by, the end of the 1850s, he had more or less written himself into silence as far as fiction was concerned. But it's obviously with the substantial amount of poetry he wrote all during the remainder of his life until he wrote Billy Budd in the early around 1890, which exists now to plague generations of high school students forever, I suppose,
mm-hmm.
He was pretty forgotten, wasn't he, until really 1929. And it's interesting, if you look at the early histories of American literature published in the 1880s and 90s, he was still a writer of boys' books. It was Typee and Omu, as by which you remember. I've just been reading the criticism of Edith Wharton, and she sees him as simply a writer of adventure. She hadn't even heard of it. But none of her contemporaries had, really. It wasn't until the 1920s that Melville began the great Melville boom.
Recite the sequence. Who are the significant American novelists, whether
Mark
they're
Twain,
in or not in
certainly.
The canon, from, say, the post-Civil War on through the rest of the 19th century?
Mark Twain, William Dean Howells.
Twain really taught America how to speak.
Yeah.
He taught us how to listen to our voices. I mean, Hemingway, of course, valorized Twain for this.
Twain, Howells, we'll certainly count Henry James, even though he's living in England most of the time.
And the great naturalists at the turn of the century, whether elegantly ironic like Stephen Crane or enormously energetic and ideological like Jack London and Frank Norris as well, and Crane, Norris, Dreiser in London. Crane in London both dead in 1900 and 1902, a great loss for the early 20th century American
canon. Ernest Hemingway says someplace that all American literature really begins with, it isn't true, and I'm not quite sure what he means, but it begins with Huckleberry Finn by Mr. Mark Twain.
It's said in the great unread Hemingway book, The Green Hills of Africa, which everyone forgets, maybe justly except for that.
But we want to hear a little bit of Huckleberry Finn in the voice of Mark Twain as represented by Hal Holbrook in his famous performances. We've got this on tape, and here it is.
I'd go to sleep, and sometimes Jim wouldn't wake me when it was my turn to stand watch. He often done that. Then when I woke up long by daybreak, he'd be sitting there with his head down betwixt his knees, moaning and mourning. I never took no notice nor let on, but I knowed what it was for. He was thinking about his wife and children way up yonder, and he was feeling low and homesick, because you see, he had never been away from home before in his life. And I do reckon he cared just much for his people as white folks does for theirs. It don't seem natural, but I reckon it's so. We kept looking for Cairo down at the foot of Illinois, where the Ohio River comes in. We said we'd sell the raft and get on a steamboat and go way up the Ohio amongst the free states, then be out of trouble. Jim, he says, made him all over trembling, feverish, be so close to freedom. He says how the first thing he'd do when he got to a free state, he would go to work saving up money and never spend a single cent. And when he got enough, he would buy his wife, which was owned on a farm near Miss Watson. And then they would both go to work and buy the two children. And if their master wouldn't sell them, he'd get an abolitionist to go and steal them. Why, it most froze me to hear such talk. Well, Jim, he wouldn't ever dare talk such talk in his life before, coming right out flat-footed and saying he would steal his children. Children which were owned by a man I didn't even know. Man who had never done me no harm. You see, I begun to get it through my head that he was most free, and who was to blame for it? By me. It had never come down me before what this thing was that I was doing. My conscience got to stirring me up hotter and hotter. And finally I says, with all that up on me, will you? I'll paddle ashore at the first light and tell. Very soon one showed. Jim, he got all excited because he thought it was Cairo. But I says, no, let me paddle ashore in the canoe and see Jim. It might not be, you know. Well, then he got the canoe ready for me and gave me the paddle and I settled out. When I was about 50 yards off, he calls out, there you goes. The old true Huck. The only white gentleman that ever kept his promise, old Jim. I just felt sick. Yeah, I was paddling off all in a sweat to tell on him. But when he says that, it just kind of seemed to take the tuck right out of me. And I wasn't right down certain whether I was glad I started or whether I weren't. But I says to myself, I got to do it. I can't get out of it. And then along comes a skiff with two men in it, with guns. And they stop, and I stop, and one of them says, "What's that yonder?" "A piece of raft. You bong on it?" "Yes, sir." "Any men on it?" "Only one, sir." "Well, those five niggers run off now up yonder around the head of the bend. Is your man what? Off left." "He's white." They went off. I know that done wrong. I guess weren't no use for me to learn to do right. Body that don't get started right when he's little, this thing got no show. Then I says to myself, "Hold on. If I'd have done right and give Jim up, would I feel better than I do now?" "Well, no," I says, "I'd feel bad. I feel the same way I do right now." "Well," says I, "what's the use in my learning to do right? And it's troublesome to do right, and ain't no trouble to do wrong."
Boy, that is a passage, isn't it? Mm-hmm. And how interesting to hear it in the voice of the old Mark Twain doing a public reading, as portrayed by Al Holbrook, though. It's an adolescent boy who is engaging in this memory and in these ruminations, these moral ruminations and self-recriminations.
Well, it's a remarkable, the entire novel is a remarkable study in the evolution of a conscience. And, and what it proves, too, is that Huck is a slow learner in the sense that when he learns something, he grabs onto it.
He's got a good heart.
And, you know, he takes two steps forward and one step back, and it is remarkably... has remarkable fidelity to the way we generally sort of wander our way through our moral decisions.
And it still reflects the great American agony, an agony that led to the Civil War, that is expressed in the Civil War, and this is post-Civil War. It's an agony that continues to this day, the agony over the black and the white.
Yes, it's a little bit easier for Twain, of course, from the vantage point of 1880 to nostalgically recreate 1835. In other words, if you want the real crisis documents about American slavery, I think it's still more important to read the work of the 1840s and the 1850s. But in what we can say that Twain was unsurpassed by anyone. Twain told America how America negotiates its own moral quandaries and decisions. And it doesn't matter whether the question is slavery or the question of just doing right by another fellow human being. There's a universal quality to Huck's knowledge. Problem is, of course, at the end of the novel, he seems to forget everything he's learned for a while when Tom Sawyer comes back, but I think that's part of Twain's message, too. Twain, of course, and Huckleberry Finn had the courage, really the guts, to take down Tom Sawyer, who had been a hero who had gotten him on the literary map in the first place. And not too many writers are willing to do that, to go back in there and show the shortcomings of a character the way he did, and in the sense that Tom Sawyer plays at the kind of things that Huckleberry Finn plays for, which is a moral imagination.
Don't you think
real survival.
That Tom Sawyer was part of him, too? It was the represented the divided side of him.
Yes.
And they all sort of hung in balance. I think that boy, Tom Sawyer, was prominent right through his life, along with the naysayer and the savage critic.
Well, Tom Sawyer would have been an investor in the Page typesetting machine.
He wouldn't.
Tom Sawyer would have been a speculator.
No, he said, yeah.
In,
remember when
stock
he
markets?
When Tom Sawyer says what he's going to do with the money? He wants to go either to go to West Point, and become a general, and become a very successful man.
Gentlemen, we must pause once again. Some commercials are vastly overdue, and then we shall return and discuss additional American authors. I'm beginning to feel the frustration of the impossibility of really doing proper representation of American literature.
We have, what, 5 minutes more?
No, we have until 11 o'clock.
Oh, we have 11.
But we're not going to cover everything until by 11 o'clock, and you can be sure of that. We also have a few more rounds of commercials. And here's the next, and then we'll be directly back. Capsule version of the history of American literature. I'm beginning to feel deeply frustrated that there's so many fine and significant figures and whole periods in the history of American literature that we cannot give proper attention to or even give mention to tonight. All the same, American fiction flourished in this century and towards the end of the last. And we want to talk about the great American novelists and the great American novel. And we're not still waiting for the great American novel. Many great American novels have been done and are available, and many of them are available, of course, in the Library of America series. Possibly one place to begin is at the very turn of the century, the year 1900, when one of our great American writers does a book which is set largely in Chicago. I'm thinking of Theodore Dreiser and Sister Carrie. And Chris, you've got that book in your hand at the moment.
Yes, well, Dreiser, of course, represents a transition figure in American fiction in the 20th century because he is that journalist who comes from to the city with a magnet for so many of the writers after the Civil War. And Dreiser himself, as a boy from Indiana, from a wretched home situation, was always filled with a sense of wonder about the city, but he also saw it with a dead, cold, clear eye as well. And in his heroine, Carrie Meeber, the heroine of Sister Carrie, as she comes to the city for the first time, we get, at the very beginning of Sister Carrie, an image of Chicago as she comes on the train, and also a very shrewd appraisal of her and her potential in the city. And the first chapter is called The Magnet Attracting, A Waif Amid Forces, which, of course, is very much in the post-Darwinian setting of a character who has no chance amidst the forces that have been unleashed upon that character. When Caroline Meeber boarded the afternoon train for Chicago, her total outfit consisted of a small trunk, a cheap imitation alligator skin satchel, a small lunch in a paper box, and a yellow leather snap purse containing her ticket, a scrap of paper with her sister's address in Van Buren Street, and $4 in money. It was in August 1889. She was 18 years of age, bright, timid, and full of the illusions of ignorance and youth. Whatever touch of regret at parting characterized her thoughts, it was certainly not for advantages now being given up. A gush of tears at her mother's farewell kiss, a touch in her throat when the cars clacked by the flour mill where her father worked by day, a pathetic sigh as the familiar green environs of the village passed in review, and the threads which bound her so lightly to a girlhood and home were irretrievably broken. To be sure, there was always the next station where one might descend and return. There was the great city, bound more closely by these very trains which came up daily. Columbia City was not so very far away, even once she was in Chicago. What prey is a few hours, a few hundred miles? She looked at the little slip bearing her sister's address and wondered. She gazed at the green landscape, now passing a swift review, until her swifter thoughts replaced its impression with vague conjectures of what Chicago might be. When a girl leaves her home at 18, she does one of two things. Either she falls into saving hands and becomes better, or she rapidly assumes the cosmopolitan standard of virtue and becomes worse. Of an intermediate balance under the circumstances, there is no possibility. The city has its cunning wiles, no less than the infinitely smaller and more human tempter. There are large forces which allure all the soulfulness of expression possible in the most cultured human. The gleam of a thousand lights is often as effective as the persuasive light in a wooing and fascinated eye. Half the undoing of the unsophisticated and natural mind is accomplished by forces wholly superhuman. A blare of sound, a roar of life, a vast array of human hives appeal to the astonished senses in equivocal terms. Without a counselor at hand to whisper cautious interpretations, what falsehoods may not these things breathe into the unguarded ear? Unrecognized for what they are, their beauty, like music, too often relaxes, then weakens, then perverts the simpler human perceptions. This is Dreiser at his most sentimental, but at the same time, he's talking honestly about the astonishing fact in Sister Carrie that streetlights sometimes are more important than people. Shoes beckoning to someone in a store window take on a greater life than the person who might wear them. Dreiser, at the beginning of the 20th century, sees consumer culture omnivorous and all around us. He is fascinated by things like the first public telephone in a department store. Sister Carrie is full of these markers of what we've come to know as the 20th century life. Dreiser would have hung out in malls. He would have written a great novel about malls. He would have seen shopping malls as something like the late 20th century American experience, the way he saw the urban America as the early 20th century.
And he sees the city as the seducer of young women.
Yes, and he does it in a way that both
which is what this book is all about.
Yeah, he mimics the popular ladies' magazines of the day, which he then became editor of in the early 20th century, as well as always standing apart from it and observing it as the outsider. There was nothing that he missed in his eye.
You know, one thing that came to my mind as you were reading that, I was remembering that his brother, Paul Dreiser, was a musician and is the composer of that great, by now, jazz standard, Back Home in Indiana.
He also wrote On the Banks of the Wabash.
On the Banks of the Wabash, yeah.
As Dresser.
Paul Dresser, exactly.
There is a Paul Dresser rest stop on the turnpike in Indiana. There was no such notice in Indiana of Theodore Dreiser, however.
There's a wonderful bit smack in the middle of Sister Carrie, where the protagonist and Hurstwood, I think, have gone to a point outside of where Chicago has been built up to. Nevertheless, there are still streetlights laid out along the lines of where the streets are going to be. I think it's always a wonderful moment of the way Dreiser sees the city in transition and sort of imagines the lines it's going to fill in the future.
Chicago at the turn of the century is represented in a number of novels, is it not? There's the Jungle, is that the one by?
That's by Upton Sinclair.
By Upton Sinclair, which is about
not a happy part of Chicago.
Not at all.
Packing town.
It's about the
meatpacking.
About the meatpacking industry.
Yes.
Right.
But there were the novel that we can't remember that you we might
admit. Fuller.
Henry Blake Fuller wrote wonderful stories of three rather striking novels about Chicago, and then there is Harold Frederick. I mean, not Harold Frederick, but
Robert Herrick.
Robert Herrick, Memoirs of an American Citizen.
Hmm.
It's interesting that the writers that you've mentioned all started. Many of them started out as journalists. William Dean Howells started out as a newspaper. Mark Twain learned how to set a type. Dreiser, Jack London.
Hemingway.
And later Hemingway, it was a school of the new realistic fiction. And I think it's also interesting how the city, for these writers, and I think that passage that you read, Chris, about the allure of the city, is something that was going against the early pre-Civil War American writers, and even to a degree afterwards, that the city was something that you escaped from. That it was the countryside that was wholesome and beautiful, and the city was, as you say, the nursery of sin. Dreiser was Sister Carrie, wasn't he?
Yes,
he was going through the same experiences, and his account of coming to Chicago in those wonderful autobiographical books that he wrote, that once he had seen Chicago, once he had seen Cleveland, once he had seen St. Louis, no more cornfields for him.
I'm going to keep him down on the farm after they've seen Chicago.
Well, a transitional figure would be Sherwood Anderson, too.
And Sherwood Anderson, too, who makes the jump.
Mm-hmm. Comes to Chicago and also New Orleans, and is someone who was really at the birth of both Hemingway and Faulkner, working with both of them in the 1920s. Mm-hmm.
There are so many writers one could talk about, and time is so short, and I want to also invite a few telephone calls. So let me instantly interrupt myself to say that we're opening the lines of the number 591-7200, 591-7200, and the area code 312 if you're calling from way down deep in Indiana or elsewhere in the country. 591-7200, we, like the Marines, who need a few good men, we need a few good telephone calls, and we'll look forward to them, and we'll pause quickly to catch up with the commercial schedule and then directly back.
Berg.
And we return to Daniel Aaron, to Chris Messenger, to Benjamin Golubov, and to Max Rudin, who, to give his title again, is publisher of the Library of America, about which we've been talking, and all of the authors we've mentioned tonight are included therein. We haven't said it's a beautiful series, it's a great and significant contribution to American letters and to American literacy, but we haven't said how people can get their hands on it. Of course, it's in the better bookstores, but still.
Absolutely. Well, there are 90 volumes so far, and there are more every year. I should say it's an ongoing series. The books are available both in bookstores, and you can check your local bookstore, but they're also available directly from the Library of America by subscription. If you want to subscribe to the series, you get a discount. And also you can write or call us for a catalog of all titles published to date. The address is Library of America, 14 East 60th Street, New York, New York, 10022. And the phone number is 212-308-3360. And we have a catalog which has the complete list.
And you must have a web page or something.
Coming soon.
Coming soon.
Coming soon to a computer near you.
Give the address again.
14 East 60th Street, that's 60th Street, New York, New York, 10022.
And the phone number again is?
Is 212-308-3360.
Excellent. Now then, gentlemen, here's my plan. Time is very short. We will work in some calls. We'll go to the phones in about 5 minutes. So all I can do to handle the 20th century is to ask you, from Dreiser on forward, who are the 10 writers or so who are essential to any temporary canonical list that we're going to work up? Who would you insist must be on that list?
He's seriously out of fashion now, but I suppose I'd say Hemingway. If only, you know, from the point of view of a teacher, you want your students to read, among other people, writers whom their parents and their parents' parents have read, and Hemingway has, attracted generations of American readers now. I think he's also important in what he did to American prose, what he did for American prose, sort of ironing it out, simplifying it, giving it some of the immediacy of the journalistic writing of his day. And Hemingway, you know, created a version of the American hero, the hard-boiled, tight-lipped, but suffering inside, figure who, for good or ill, is with us now.
Nobody could possibly disagree with that. So that's the first of the ten. Who else is in there? We needn't do it in chronological order,
Faulkner,
but in this century, Faulkner.
Consensus on Faulkner, I would think.
Faulkner did get the Nobel Prize, which doesn't mean much necessarily. Hemingway did not, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, he did. Yeah. Yeah,
he did?
Oh. No, Hemingway didn't.
I didn't think so.
I believe he
yes,
did,
he did
and 53.
And he's after The Old Man in the Sea.
And he sent his medal from Stockholm to Ezra Pound in the Nut House.
Right. Yeah. It was an afterthought kind of prize. Mm-hmm.
And he was furious, of course, that Faulkner got it first.
Yeah.
Well, per book won the Nobel Prize, too.
Yes.
Doesn't necessarily...
Sinclair Lewis.
Well, yes, I was going to mention, if you're thinking of writers who had this enormous influence and created a Babbitt. I mean, even to use that term, it's mm-hmm. added a word to our language as a sort of paradigm, some kind of American type. And we, of course, would have to include Dreiser, who was writing, you know, his The American Tragedy was published mm-hmm. in 1927. Was that right? Or 25?
25.
Yeah. But you're putting Sinclair Lewis on the list as well, aren't you?
I think I would put Sinclair Lewis on it.
Yeah.
And
I loved him. I was deeply excited by Sinclair Lewis mm-hmm. when I discovered him as an adolescent.
Mm-hmm.
I think I read first Babbitt and mm-hmm. then read Main yeah. Street and then read...
Now I would say Edith Wharton.
Edith Wharton.
Particularly The House of Mirth and The Custom of the Country in the Age of Innocence, those New York mm-hmm. novels.
Yeah. As we come closer to our period...
About Cather.
Yeah, Willa Cather.
Willa Cather. That's not closer to our period, but certainly. My Antonia, particularly?
An O Pioneer.
Would you recommend one novel?
Well, I'd say My Antonia or O Pioneers.
Yeah.
I think everyone has a reader of Cather has a favorite. Some mm-hmm. people be The Professor's House. And
Death Comes to the Archbishop, isn't that?
Well, that wouldn't be mine.
It's curious. It's a curious piece, all
yeah,
the same.
Yeah.
Who else?
Well, I think someone, I think Epcot Fitzgerald
is a
remarkable writer for the rare beauty of his writing, for his meditation on the legacy of the Romantic poets, for mm-hmm. his attempt to, in the throes of his own despair in the 1930s, write, I think, one of the great American classic books, which is Tender as the Night, and also attempt at the end of his life, he died at 44 in 1940, The Last Tycoon, which was a wonderful novel, not only about Hollywood, but about American labor.
He did not finish it, did he?
No, he did not. He died. He died with it in progress. But we have a remarkable scaffolding for the book and the notes to the book that Edmund Wilson so lovingly put together after Fitzgerald's death. I find that students of all genders and ages still respond to his rare sense of romance and possibility in human life, and he is a great stylist.
Among writers still living, who would be essential to that?
You have to say Updike. 30 years of very, very distinguished fiction. Someone who I think holds up the tradition of Howellsian realism. We haven't talked enough about Howells, but World Enough and Time.
Yeah.
And somebody who, for people of our generation, has really mapped a landscape in America that is very, very familiar. You read Rabbit Redux and you remember what the fast food in 1970 tasted like.
Do Mailer and Bellow belong on that?
Bellow certainly does, I think. I think in some ways he is the greatest of the American writers, in my opinion, since post-World War II. A writer of great intellectual profundity, extraordinary observational powers, I mean, of creating cities. I think he's actually, for me, the poet of Chicago, even more than Sandburg.
Sandburg isn't much of a poet, really, is he?
Well, I was thinking of, you know, of the city of the big shoulders and all that sort of stuff. The feel of the city, at the same time, enormous culture, which he wears very lightly. I think he brings it in, it's organic to his work. It isn't stuck in any way. He's a very powerful mind, very powerful intellect.
He wears it lightly, but he displays it frequently.
Yes.
Yeah. Gentlemen, time being quite short, I keep saying that tonight because I'm so eager to talk about so many things we don't have time to work in. All the same, let us go to the telephones. Lots of people are waiting, would like to get in on this conversation, and here is one of them. Good evening, you're on the air.
Yes, hi. I just wanted to mention how appreciative I was of being able to read the entire Lincoln-Douglas debates in one volume.
Mm-hmm.
And how in the series I was able to just trace through a straight line the development of Lincoln's thinking and in coalescing the American public opinion on the whole slavery question, from the House divided speech through the debates, the Cooper Union speech and such, and they have it all together in one book is really fantastic.
Mm-hmm. So that's a plug for the Library of America generally and Lincoln volumes particularly.
Can I make just a comment on that? I think you're quite right. What's so wonderful about having them together is that often they were presented separately, but they can't be. They come together. It's a sort of synergistic principle. They each influence the other. There's something tremendously dramatic in the exchanges. And when you read them this way, I think it makes all the difference in the world. Why that? I think it is the greatest political debate ever conducted on American soil.
Our thanks to the caller, and let us go quickly to another. And here is that other. Good evening.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. First, I want to commend you on a fantastic show. I'm a regular listener, and it's just wonderful to know that you're keeping this type of conversation alive in our great city.
In the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king.
This is addressed to the gentleman from the Library of America.
Yes.
I'm also a big fan of that series. And I just wanted to ask, Mr. Rosenberg's raised the point several times this evening, it's very difficult to decide which authors to give your attention to because there's so many good ones. And I just want to know, what is the criteria the Library of America uses to include or exclude an author? And would they ever delete an author based on popular or critical erosion of reputation?
The issue of the canon arises.
That's a good question. The mission of the Library of America is to bring into print, to keep in print forever, as long as we possibly can, all the significant and best writing of the American literary heritage. So the reason we tend to publish only writers whose reputations are already settled is because we want to make sure that that we can keep them in print forever. That's answered part of your question.
Okay.
The criteria are basically two. Literary quality is one, and historical significance is another. But the order in which we publish the volume really depends on many other factors that have much to do more to do with the publishing world rights and so forth.
Sir, we thank you for the call. We pause a last quick round of commercials and then back for a few more calls. on 591-7200. And we'll go directly back to the phones. Here is the next caller. Good evening. You're on the air. Hello, are you there?
Hello?
Yes, sir. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you. Yes, I'm a subscriber to the Library of America series, and I've particularly enjoyed a two-volume set entitled Reporting World War II, which consists of first-hand reports from the battlefields of World War II.
Sir, I gather this is a long-distance call. Where are you calling from?
Dallas.
Dallas, Texas. Yes, sir.
And I've immensely enjoyed the series. I've collected approximately 15 books so far.
I should say that Reporting World War II was the first chance we had really to pay tribute to American journalism. And you'll probably be interested to know that coming up in the next year or so is a similar volume devoted to the journalistic writing on the Vietnam War.
Thank you very much.
Yep. We thank you, sir, for the call. Glad to have heard from you, and we will go on to the next. And here is that next call. Good evening.
Good evening. I received the Library of America series, which I'm very happy with, and I have a question about whether or not they will be publishing some regional writers that are perhaps lesser known but very fine. For example, I discovered a writer, Harriet Simpson Arnaud, when I was visiting Berea College Museum in Kentucky, and her works are very fine. Her first work, Mountain Path, is not in print anymore. I'm trying to get that, but she has other works in print. And I know that in the various regions, there are probably just as many treasures of writers, and I'd certainly like to see some of those.
I agree with you about Harriet Arnaud. I have not read the first novel. I did read The Dollmaker. And I think it's an extremely powerful work. One of the problems when we do the Library of America is that we have to have, if we're going to devote one volume to a writer, there has to be a fairly substantial body of material. Now, I dare say if we followed it up, and I it's something that I would like to do, and I'm going to recommend that we do it, just to see what kind of a volume we might make. What we do then, after we have thought of a possible candidate for the Library of America, we send it out to consultants and ask their opinions. And after that, we have a general discussion before we decide whether we're going to do it or not. But I'm very grateful to you for mentioning her, and also your point about local color writers. I don't know if you would call Flannery O'Connor a local color writer. I wouldn't.
Would.
I think she's
a
great
Bret
writer.
Hart, perhaps, too.
But Kate Chopin and some others, we'll eventually, I'm sure we're going to publish them. How and what form, I can't say yet.
The other thing to say is, though, although we're a nonprofit company, we have no ongoing subvention or support of any kind. So when there's an author who's deserving, we'd like to do, that we don't feel will actually be commercially viable, we have to wait until we have special support or funding for that volume.
All right, thanks for the caller. Give us the forecast. Time is almost out. Of what's coming next? You've got your plans for the next publishing season, I'm sure.
Yes, I do. Well, in this season, we just finished publishing the second volume of John Steinbeck, a volume of John Passages USA, which Dan Aaron was co-editor on, a collection of James Thurber, the largest and best collection ever published, edited by Garrison Keillor, another famous radio personality, and a three-volume set of Vladimir Nabokov's complete English language novels and memoir. That's the fall season. Coming up in 97, we have a collection of George Washington's writings, John Muir, Nature Writings, followed up in the Bartram volume, and then later in the year, Nathaniel West, a collection of Wild Stevens, and a collection of American crime novels, which would be an interesting follow-up to our Raymond Chandler set we published last year.
Sounds wonderful. Gentlemen, I thank you most sincerely for joining us. Our guests have been Max Rudin, publisher of the Library of America, Daniel Aaron, one of the founders of the library, and professor of English emeritus at Harvard University, Benjamin Golubov, professor of English at Lake Forest College, Chris Messenger, professor of English at the University of Illinois, Chicago. A few quick words about programs to come. Tomorrow night we're going to look at investing, the stock market, and other available investment opportunities. Our guest, Jim Annable, chief economist at First Chicago, and Eugene Lerner, who runs an investment firm in town. But with that, we'll thank our guests again. Thanks to all for listening, and a cordial good night.